This week we continue our study of Proverbs 10 through 29 with a consideration of verses relevant to government, most specifically to the king and to the courts. Ancient Israel had a system of governance somewhat different from that which exists in the modern day, but many of the principles applied to its rulers can be applied to anyone in any leadership capacity in the modern day. Herein we learn that it is good to have the favor of those in power, and that we should want those in power to be good, so that our good behavior will gain us their favor. We will find that if a leader wants to be successful, he should be righteous, because that will tend toward his greatest stability and the best of those whom he leads. We also will find that those in a position to judge should judge by God's moral standards, operating just hearings and making good judgments in accordance with the facts and the law. Since we are drawing from a number of scattered verses today, you have no particular passage for consideration, and I recommend that you continue to study Proverbs 10 through 29 on your own. Before we dig into the Proverbs about the courts and the kings, we should have a brief consideration of the structure of ancient Israel's government because it differed considerably from others in the modern Western world. Ancient Israel had no legislature. Their laws were given to them by God on Mount Sinai, and so they were set, quite literally, in stone, as with the Ten Commandments. Moses established a tiered judiciary to interpret the laws. This judiciary was backed by the priesthood. The final judge was the high priest, who, as you will recall, served in the tabernacle and later the temple with the Ten Commandments themselves. The law of Moses did not establish a king or any other kind of executive, but the people chose in later generations to establish a king for the purpose of having him defeat their enemies in battle. The king was appointed to his position by a coronation accepted by all the people. The precise duties of the king are unclear, but in addition to being a military leader, we can see many times in the reign of King David that the king would be involved in judgment. That makes some sense. The guy with the strength to force his will would be the one to make the decisions, since he could essentially do what he wanted and no one could challenge him. It is unclear how exactly the courts were arranged under the kings or how the power between the king and the priests was balanced. However, we do read in Deuteronomy 17 that the king was obligated to submit to the law of Moses. We will discuss the king first. Whether or not you like the king, whether or not he is deserving of being the king, whether or not you even think that there ought to be a king, the king, or some powerful person, will be a reality that you cannot ignore. Someone is going to have the power. Someone will have the wealth, someone will have the social backing, someone will have the weapons. And with such things, someone is going to have the power to get others to do what he tells them to do. Maybe you'll be that person, but in most cases, you won't be. And when you aren't, you will have to accept the practical reality of someone else's power. That means that you want to get along with the king. If you get along with him, he can do good things for you. If you don't get along with him, then he can do very bad things to you. Proverbs 22 says, "The terror of a king is like the growling of a lion. Whoever provokes him to anger forfeits his life." Proverbs 19:12 says, "A king's wrath is like the growling of a lion, but his favor is like dew on the grass." Proverbs 16:14-15 says, "A king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. In the light of a king's face there is life, and his favor is like the clouds that bring the spring rain." So how does one get the favor of the king? Proverbs 14:35 says, "A servant who deals wisely has the king's favor, but his wrath falls on one who acts shamefully." Proverbs 22:11 says, "He who loves purity of heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king as his friend." So the claim here is that the king likes a wise person with a pure heart and gracious speech. Now, to some degree, I think that presumes goodness in the king. A bad king, I think, would not like a person who has a pure heart, even if he might appreciate wisdom and gracious speech. So I think we have to take this and some other descriptions of the king as generalities. It is also unclear to me just how often Solomon is intentionally referring to himself alone when he says the king. Perhaps when he says, "He who loves purity of heart will have the king as his friend," he means, "He who loves purity of heart will have me as his friend." But for now, let's leave those caveats alone and presume that a wise person with a pure heart and good speech will get along with the king, while a person with shameful actions will receive the king's wrath. The Proverbs often speak to what makes a king great and to what lays him low. We first note that the term monarchy is something of a misnomer in that it implies that one person, the king, has all the power. But really, there is no one person who has power alone. The king may lead the army, but he doesn't win the war without soldiers. The king may build great works, but he doesn't build them without laborers, and he doesn't pay those laborers or soldiers without others who give the fruits of their labors to his administration. If all of those people simply refused to support the king, he would be no king at all. It is for that reason that Proverbs 14:28 says, "In a multitude of people is the glory of a king, but without people a prince is ruined." To get the support of all those people and to keep it for the long haul, the king has to behave himself. Proverbs 16:12 says, "It is an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness." As a general rule, doing evil brings about bad consequences. Those bad consequences will make the king weaker, and the people won't like those bad consequences either. Eventually, they'll get fed up with bad behavior and will withdraw their support. Then the king will be ruined. On the other hand, righteousness will bring benefits and people will generally support that. So if a king wants to be established, it is in his interest to be righteous. The alternative would be to tear down his own rule by wickedness and then he would lose his kingdom. We note that the world is built with a certain feedback loop. Wickedness is generally self-destructive and righteousness is generally self-preserving. If the king wants to be successful, he should also surround himself with the right people. Proverbs 25:4 and 5 say, "Take away the dross from the silver, and the smith has material for a vessel. Take away the wicked from the presence of the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness." I am reminded of 1 Corinthians 15:33, which says that bad company ruins good morals. This is as true for the king as for everyone else. If the king surrounds himself with the wrong kind of people, they will cause him problems that he will have to deal with, and he will also likely sink into ruinous misbehavior along with them. And this works in reverse as well. Bad company corrupts a good king, but a bad king also attracts bad company. Proverbs 29:12 says, "If a ruler listens to falsehood, all his officials will be wicked." Part of the righteousness of a good king is that he issues good judgments. Proverbs 29:14 says, "If a king faithfully judges the poor, his throne will be established forever." There is obviously a temptation for a person making a judgment to side with the wealthy person, the one who is established, the one who is socially credible, the one who might give a bribe. But a good judge makes decisions based on a faithful application of moral laws to the facts. Common people are not stupid. They can tell when their judges are twisting the facts and ignoring the moral realities. When a judge consistently departs from the truth, he eventually loses the trust of the people, and as the people go, so goes the power of the kingdom. Judgments mean nothing unless someone is willing to enforce them. Proverbs 29:4 carries a similar sentiment. "By justice a king builds up the land, but he who exacts gifts tears it down." The bribe might be tempting, but in the end it will not benefit the king as much as justice will. Concerning the king as a judge, we also have several scriptures. I must say I find some of these to be a little hard to swallow in that they seem to apply more to Solomon talking about himself than they do to all judges in general. They tend to speak to how good a king is at judging, but that obviously will vary considerably by the king. To put the verses into their proper context, we note that the Proverbs, as we have seen and will see, also acknowledge that some kings are wicked. Obviously, we couldn't apply Proverbs about good judgment to them also. Solomon himself was renowned for his incredible skills in judgment, so I think his perspective on a king's judgment, as reflected here, skews in his own direction. Proverbs 25:2 says, "It is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings is to search things out." Obviously, the judge, if he is to render a just judgment, must determine accurately the facts of the case. A king who does well at this receives glory for having done so. Proverbs 20:8 says, "A king who sits on the throne of judgment winnows all evil with his eyes." To winnow is an agricultural process that separates chaff from grain. That, I suppose, suggests to us that a king can separate the evil from the good just by looking at people. This, I think, is more Solomon-specific and certainly is a generality. Most kings, I would think, cannot do this. In fact, I would go so far as to say that this verse is entirely metaphorical, the more literal intent being that the king, in general, will generally get to the truth of a matter in the course of a trial. One other proverb, 16:10, seems to speak of the infallibility of the king in judgment. It reads, An oracle is on the lips of a king. His mouth does not sin in judgment. That from the English Standard Version. The implication there would be that the king's words are divinely inspired and without error, like a word of prophecy. Of course, we can confirm that taken in that light, the verse could not be correct. We have all observed judges and others in authority issuing errant judgments. An easy example might be Roe v. Wade or Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health. In the first case, the U.S. Supreme Court held that a woman has a constitutional right to commit feticide, and in the second, that same court held that women do not have that right. So certainly at least one of those two judgments was wrong, and if you don't know which one was wrong, by the way, it was Roe. We have also seen, of course, from other scriptures that there are wicked rulers who make bad decisions. So what do we do with this proverb? Joseph Benson, in his commentary from 1857, gives this answer, quote, "As the verb is wanting, and there is nothing for is in the Hebrew, the clause may be rendered, a divine sentence should be in the lips of the king. Thus, it speaks not so much of a matter of fact, as if it were thus in all kings, which is notoriously and confessedly untrue, as of the duty of kings, in whom wisdom is a necessary qualification. And thus the two proverbs, Proverbs 16:12-13, must be understood, otherwise they are repugnant to common experience." End quote. Benson agrees with me then that we all recognize that our kings are humans who err in judgment. So it is Benson's claim that this verse, and a few others in the nearby context, when properly translated, tell us not what a king does, but what a king should do. A king should not err in judgment, but should strive for perfection. Proverbs 21:1 has a similar idea. "The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wills." This one could have the same translational issue as 16:10. However, I'm not so convinced that the context requires the adjustment. This verse does not so much say that the king's judgment is always right as it does that the king's judgment is under God's control. We know from the broad context of Scripture that all things are under God's control, and so we would have no difficulty accepting that a king's judgments, whether right or wrong, are a predetermined part of God's plan. Proverbs 25:3 says, "As the heavens for height and the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable." I suppose that what decision a king will make cannot be certainly known until it is made, and such might be said of anyone. It is critically important for a nation, if that nation has a king, to have a king who makes good decisions. For better or worse, as the king goes, so the population tends to follow. We will see that pattern throughout the book of Kings. And the sins of the people which they commit in following their wicked king will eventually become a snare for the king himself. Proverbs 28:2 says, "When a land transgresses, it has many rulers, but with a man of understanding and knowledge, its stability will long continue." The implication there, of course, is that if a king has understanding and knowledge, then the people of the land will not transgress, but if he doesn't, then they will. The transgressions of the people will result in instability, and the righteousness of the people will result in stability. For that reason, a good king will generally have a long and stable reign, while a bad king will generally have a shorter reign. In that case, the land will go through ruler after ruler, and we will see that in Kings also. On that note, we read Proverbs 14:34. "Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." So as a people, if you want to have stability and exaltation, you should be righteous and you should encourage your neighbors to be righteous. If, however, you want to be brought into reproach and instability, wickedness will take you down that path. Wicked rulers are a grave problem for a people in more ways than just leading them astray into bad conduct. Proverbs 28:15 puts it this way, "Like a roaring lion or a charging bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people." The attack of a lion or a bear is, of course, a very serious and even a deadly problem. Proverbs 28:28 also says, "When the wicked rise, people hide themselves, but when they perish, the righteous increase." A bad ruler makes good people hide their good deeds. When a bad ruler dies, good people get back to doing good, and they and their society can flourish. Proverbs 29:2 carries a similar sentiment. "When the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people groan." Proverbs 28:16 says, "A ruler who lacks understanding is a cruel oppressor. but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. So not only does the wickedness of a king cut short his reign, but it also brings cruel oppression on the people. Ultimately, we should be glad that the reign of the wicked is cut short, because they don't belong on the throne. Proverbs 19:10 says, "It is not fitting for a fool to live in luxury, much less for a slave to rule over princes." Slaves at that time were usually criminals who were working to pay off a debt owed to their victims. Alternatively, the slave might have been a person who was unable to pay his debts, which generally would imply someone who didn't work hard enough. The lazy and the criminal should not rule over others. One job of an ancient king was to conduct the wars. However, since Solomon reigned in a time of peace, it is little surprise that the Proverbs say little about war. There is, by my reckoning, only one verse that directly addresses the topic. That is Proverbs 21:31. "The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord." Obviously, God is in control of everything, and that includes being in control of the outcome of a battle. If a people is to win a war, then God must so ordain it. We expect that, in general, God will give victory to those who honor him, though that is not always the case. However, God works through the works of his people, and so his people should make military preparations even if they are trusting in God for the victory. Those are the verses about the king. We turn next to some verses about the courts. Courts are essential for resolving conflicts. When two parties are at odds with one another, someone must stand in the middle to mediate the case, or if mediation is impossible, to judge the right from the wrong. If that doesn't happen, then the two parties will necessarily remain in conflict with one another. Too much of that, and the consequences are disastrous. And so we must have a judge. And so I open with Proverbs 21:2. "Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart." Everyone thinks he is always right. God knows better. Without someone to stand in the gap between opposing forces, there will never be peace. That said, courts should be a last resort for conflicts that can't be peacefully resolved otherwise. It is not wise to leap to public accusations without a strong cause. Proverbs 25:7b through 10 says, "What your eyes have seen, do not hastily bring into court. For what will you do in the end, when your neighbor puts you to shame? Argue your case with your neighbor himself, and do not reveal another's secret, lest he who hears you bring shame upon you, and your ill repute have no end." Remember, if you start slinging mud at someone else, he'll start slinging mud back at you. Fair or not, there is always a risk to making public accusations. So if a matter is trifling, let it go. If it is important, make your best effort to resolve it privately. And only if it is both important and can't be resolved privately, then bring it to public consideration. One proverb emphasizes the importance in judging of allowing both sides to state their case, and also of having cross-examination of witnesses. Proverbs 18:17 says, "The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him." This is the difference between a fair trial and malicious gossip. If one party is allowed to air his opinion in condemnation of the other, and the other gets no opportunity to defend himself, then there is no basis to make a judgment there. Anyone can say anything if there is no one to challenge him. For this reason, it is essential that witnesses be examined in the presence of the opposing party so that he can challenge the faults of their claims. Otherwise, the one making the judgment will accept false information which has not been thoroughly vetted. We note also that it is unwise to make false accusations in court. With an open airing of the evidence, generally, the false accusations will be found out. Proverbs 26:2 says, "Like a sparrow in its flitting, like a swallow in its flying, a curse that is causeless does not alight." To curse someone is to wish evil on that someone. As we have discussed, the world is built with natural feedback loops such that bad generally comes to those who do bad, while good generally comes to those who do good. It doesn't always work out that way. But to wish for bad things to come on people who are doing good is to push back against the natural order of things. Most often, that won't be effective. In like manner, making false accusations usually won't be effective, because when all the evidence comes out, that person will be vindicated. You should not try to lay a trap for someone, because in the end, you might just be the one who gets caught in that trap. Proverbs 26:27 says, "Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling." False accusations are like that. You make an accusation you can't prove, and in the end, you just look bad. Courts should function with impartiality such that they do only justice. Proverbs 18:5 says, "It is not good to be partial to the wicked or to deprive the righteous of justice." Proverbs 17:15 says, "He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous are both alike an abomination to the Lord." We note that this implies that God's laws must be the basis for a just court system. God's laws are the definition of what is righteous and what is wicked, so any court that judges by a different standard is, by this passage, abominable. Judges must be certain to apply God's laws rightly and fairly. Proverbs 17:26 says, "To impose a fine on a righteous man is not good, nor to strike the noble for their uprightness." If courts are to implement justice, they must be administered by the right people. Proverbs 28:5 says, "Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand it completely." Not only do God's people understand justice, but they love it. Proverbs 21:15 says, "When justice is done, it is a joy to the righteous, but terror to evildoers." Obviously, wicked people don't want the rules to be enforced because the rulers will be enforcing those rules against them. Proverbs 28:4 says, "Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive against them." There will be a natural conflict between the just and the unjust. Proverbs 29:27 also says, "An unjust man is an abomination to the righteous, but one whose way is straight is an abomination to the wicked." If a court does justice, the wicked will fear it. Proverbs 28:1 says, "The wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion." When a man knows that he is in the wrong, he fears he will be attacked by the righteous, and he runs. Often in investigating a crime, the guilty party is identified because he's the person who suddenly skipped town even before anyone was looking for him. A righteous person, in contrast, will often demand a trial and march in to steadfastly defend his innocence. In implementing justice, the courts must be sure they punish murder, and the people should support their judgments when they do so. Proverbs 28:17 says, "If one is burdened with the blood of another, he will be a fugitive until death. Let no one help him." In considering the courts, we can't ignore the influence of bribes. Unfortunately, that issue has been prominent in the news lately, with credible claims that a number of U.S. Supreme Court justices, particularly Clarence Thomas, have accepted extensive gifts from people who had cases before the court. In general, the Proverbs say that bribes are bad, but also acknowledge that bribes can be effective, because for better or worse, wicked judges will accept them. We have a handful of verses on the topic, but I'm not going to address those here because we've already considered them in a previous message, How to Gain Wealth, published on July 16th of 2023. Ultimately, even the best performing courts will be imperfect. Man can give some semblance of justice, but man cannot give perfect justice. Ultimately, we all must wait on God's final judgments to give us justice perfectly. Proverbs 29:26 says, "Many seek the face of a ruler, but it is from the Lord that a man gets justice." To conclude, then, the Proverbs give us much wisdom about governance. Herein, we find that to avoid conflicts, it is essential to have just courts, which can determine who is right and wrong in a conflict. To properly resolve those conflicts, the court must judge in accordance with God's moral laws, and they must give fair hearings, allowing both sides to be presented and witnesses to be cross-examined, to ensure that the facts of the case are correctly determined. It is an abomination to deprive the righteous of justice. It is also critically important that righteous people serve in positions of power. Wicked rulers are a terror to good people and to the good that they do, which brings harm on all of society. And being righteous in accord with God's standard is also in the best interest of those in positions of power, because right actions give them stability and success. Leaders should surround themselves with the right kinds of people, that they be not led astray, and we should strive to be the right kind of people, that we might have favor from good leaders. Those general guidelines make for wise governance.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.